Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, we explore a secret world of migrants, human smuggling, and trafficking. First, migrants leave their country in search of safety or a better life, but many are abducted, enslaved, or disappeared, never to be seen again. We begin with an award-winning journalist who has documented the lives of Central American migrants and the life-threatening dangers they face. We then dig deeper into the world of migration and the systems and policies that perpetuate many of the inhumane conditions. With us is award-winning journalist Oscar Martinez. He followed migrants from Central America into Mexico on their quest for better lives or safety. Oscar Martinez documented the harrowing tales of abductions, forced labor, sex slavery, and disappearances in his book, The Beast, Riding the Rails and Dodging the Narcos on the Migrant Trail. Welcome, Oscar Martinez. It's great to have you here with us.
Thank you.
I'd like to start with how you did the research for this book. You had to physically go onto the so-called migrant trail and take the same transportation that migrants are taking and really face some of the same circumstances in a way. How did you yourself stay safe?
First of all, thank you for the interest in that topic, in that tragedy of thousands and thousands of Central American migrants who crossed Mexico without papers. I started the work on the road in 2008. I arrived to Mexico in 2006, in May of 2006, and I made some incursions to the trip of migrants to write some reports for some reviews in Mexico. And I saw that this complex problem that migrants suffer in Mexico after the organized crime involved in the trip of migrants discovered that they can get a profit with these undocumented migrants, the story of that people definitely changed and start a new era in the way of the migrants. So I thought in that moment that it was impossible make a coverage just making incursions to the way of the migrants. And I decided with my newspaper, who is elfaro.net, an online newspaper from El Salvador, to start it for 2 years in a house to travel like a migrant in some parts of the way of this horrible trip of the Central American migrants in Mexico. I do that for 2 years and a half in Mexico. We went in the south frontier, we went in the north frontier, and of course, eight times. I say we because I worked with a photographer who called El Ponces. Of course, we made eight trips in the beast, in the train that the migrants take to cross Mexico.
When they ride atop of the train, how did you stay safe?
It's difficult, but I have to be fair with that. I'm not a migrant. I mean, you as a reporter, you can experiment a lot of risk, but you are not a migrant. You are not the hero of your story. I just watched what happened with these people who can't leave that places. I could leave the places of the migration and came back to Mexico City to write and to stay calm for some days or some weeks. These people can do that for 2 or 3 months, can leave that hell. It's impossible. They have to live all the consequences of that hell. After say that, I have to say that our technique was very simple. We made investigative journalism, so we need time. The journalists who try to do investigative journalists need time. I think that if you have a good research with you, you're going to be safe because you understand the places where you're going to go. But if the newspaper or the media, like used to do right now in that era of internet and all that possibilities, if they give it to you 2 days or 3 days to make an investigation, that's impossible. You're going to be in danger if you pretend to cover something related with losetas in Mexico, and you don't have 2 or 3 months to make your investigation, you're going to be in a huge danger. So we have that prerogative. I had time to get in these places. I had 1 month to prepare my incursions to all the time. So I think that that's the number one rule of the safety for a journalist.
You had several individuals that you followed, that you interviewed, who were on the migrant trail and who faced really gut-wrenching circumstances. Was there one common theme among those people that you interviewed and met?
Okay, well, I can speak in present, for example. A few minutes ago that we started this interview, I was talking with an old lady, the mother of a migrant who died in 2011 in a huge massacre that Los Zetas perpetrated in the state of Tamaulipas, in the north of Mexico, frontier with Brownsville, Texas. To have an idea of what happened in Mexico, this humanitarian crisis that happened in Mexico, in 2011, this Salvadorian migrant died in a massacre where died 193 migrants of a horrible way, of course, with torture and rapes for the women, etc. I was talking with that lady a few minutes ago after I started this conversation. So in 2007, the rules of the way changed. Los Zetas are a huge band, a huge gang with a lot of connections with the police, with the authorities, with the local authorities of that Mexico that not all the people know. This is not the Mexico of the big cities. This is not the Mexico of the tourists. This is the Mexico of the little towns. This is the Mexico of the little village. This is the Mexico of the very, very, very small towns. So it's the Mexico that you never want to see. It's the Mexico where nobody want to go. It's the Mexico without big newspapers. It's the Mexico without just eight local police officers with one little gang who have to confront a huge armed organization like Los Zetas, no? Like Los Zetas or El Cartel de Sinaloa or El Cartel del Golfo. So it's a very desperate situation. That's what happened in Mexico with that population of migrants.
Let's talk about two aspects of this. First of all, you're talking about Los Zetas, the dangerous gang. Now, one of the things that you wrote about Los Zetas, you said it's really kind of like a metastasizing cancer because it has recruited so many people from so many walks of life into the gang. So almost like you don't even know who's in this gang and who isn't. How do you describe this thing now?
I have to say that one of my frustrations is don't have all the vocabulary to describe Los Zetas in the United States. What Los Zetas do in this road of migrants in Mexico is for me impossible to describe with my very poor English. Los Zetas have the control, have the complete control of some places in Mexico. They are the authorities in some places in Mexico, and I can say it's the name of some of that places: Coatzacoalcos, Apizaco, Tierra Blanca, that's in Veracruz, or for example, Tenosique. I'm talking about Tabasco, the frontier with Guatemala, with the jungle of Petén in Guatemala, the big frontier of the organized crime who want to traffic weapons, who want to traffic girls, who need to traffic, of course, drugs. I can mention, for example, Nuevo Laredo in Tamaulipas, who is a frontier with Laredo in the United States. I can mention Matamoros, who is the frontier with Brownsville, Texas. These places where the migrants need to cross have a complete control by Los Zetas. They have a powerful capacity of fire. I mean, Los Zetas can, for example, I described that in a chapter in the book. Los Zetas can kidnap 100 people in the afternoon in the center of one of these towns when the migrants arrive to these places in the top of the train. They can make that kidnap just in the afternoon with the sun up there, and anybody gonna say that? Anybody say that? Anybody do that? Because this is the most unknown Mexico. This is the Mexico that anybody want to see, because it's not necessary if you need votes, because the migrants never going to denounce with the authorities, because migrants see the authorities in Mexico as the enemy. They are involved with Los Zetas. Of course that they are involved with Los Zetas. So I feel very frustrated, because I need more words to describe to you what happened in that place with Los Zetas.
So, but essentially what you're saying is, in broad daylight, they can kidnap 100 migrants who are trying to escape some bad circumstances in their own hometowns and then put them in worse circumstances. Now, the way you described it in your book, The Beast, Riding the Rails and Dodging Narcos on the Migrant Trail, was that the primary purpose of the kidnappings is to get a ransom for each of them.
Yeah.
And that has turned into a pretty big business. Give us some numbers.
It's a business. Yeah, it's a huge business. Los Zetas want the money that the families of the migrants who live in the United States are going to pay to the coyote or to the smuggler when they make the work of cross the border with the United States. That's the money that Los Zetas want. We are talking about $150,000. That's like a comedy. But that's the money that Los Zetas want. And you can think that in 2009, this is not new for the Mexican authorities. I put you an example. In 2009, I mentioned that in one of the chronicles in the book, in the kidnap that don't matter. In 2009, the Human Rights Commission of Mexico made a report. In that report, they interviewed like around 10,000 migrants in Mexico who in those particular moment was in Mexico trying to get into the United States. The Human Rights Commission of Mexico gave a number of the profits that Los Zetas won just with that 10,000 migrants. And that profit was around $25 million. It's a huge profit for this organization of crime who discovered that they can have something, take something with people who have nothing. It's incredible how they discover the way of extortion. These people leave Central America because they need progress. But Los Zetas discovered that they have relatives or families in the United States, and that changed the story of the migration in Mexico.
Let me first remind listeners that you're listening to The Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudin, and we're speaking with Oscar Martinez, who has written a book called The Beast, Riding the Rails and Dodging Narcos on the Migrant Trail, in which he actually went on the migrant trail to find out exactly what was going on. Do you have a sense, based on your stories, you have talked about people being killed, mutilated, enslaved, kidnapped, tortured, or simply just disappeared. Is there anybody that has the numbers of how many people we're talking about in these categories?
There's some estimated, but it's impossible. These people know how to hide themselves on the road in Mexico. They know that if the authorities of the organized crime, if they cross in front of the authorities of the organized crime, they're going to have problems. That's the precedent in Mexico. So that's the reason that these people are not a problem for the Mexican authorities, because they don't denounce. Of course, they don't vote. They are not Mexican people. They don't represent a problem for the Mexican authorities. I think that I always, all the time, say that for me, it's very important that the people read the book in English, republished with Verso Books. It's very important because I think that something has to change in the minds of the people from the United States who deal with migrants from Central America who work in the United States. If they know what happened with that people to arrive to the United States, I think that something has to change in your perception of migrants if you know what happened for 1, 2, or 3 months with that people when they crossed Mexico to get in the United States. Really, I don't like this word, but really, it's a hell. It's a really, that's a word who can describe that. And it's not a common place to describe something. I think that it's honest in that case, say that this wage is a really hell for the migrants.
It takes 2 to 3 months for somebody to go from Central America up through Mexico and up to the U.S. border if they make it that far, and many of them don't. Why do people take the risk? Do they not know what they're going to face? Or is their life at home just that bad that they're willing to face something that could be much worse?
Sister, the Central American government are very responsible with that issue of migration. You have to know that the money that the migrants who live in the United States send to Central America represent a lot of the total money who moved in that countries. So the government, like the Guatemala or El Salvador or Nicaragua or Honduras, prefer to sacrifice his people and not economies. I think that there is no a lot of information here in Central America. The migrants who are the Salvadorian people who are thinking right now to take that road across Mexico for first time, they don't know exactly what happened. And they don't know because migrants who arrived to the United States don't tell the story all the time. I suppose that people feel shame of what happened in the way of Mexico. And of course, Central America is a very difficult place to live. You have to know that Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador are the North Triangle of Central America are the most violent piece of earth. I mean, in percent of homicide, it's a very difficult place to live for the people, for the work class in Central America. But I think you have to remember that the families in the Central during the wars in the 80s and 90s in Central America, thousands and thousands of Central American people lived the region and go to the United States. So we have a lot of broken families, half family living in Guatemala and half family living in the United States, in Los Angeles, in Washington, in Maryland, in Virginia. So they want to get together again. That's one of the reasons. But I think that the principal reason, it's a very normal and understanding reason. It's the need of progress, or think that your life is not going to be all the time wake up at 5 in the morning and go to a work to receive a very, very ridiculous payment for that work who make you live in the poverty. And you don't want that for your kids, and you don't want that for your family. And there is a construction, I think that a wrong construction, but there is a construction since a lot of years that in the United States you can change that way, you can change that condition. So it's the need of progress. Think that there is something else in the life that live like poor can give anything to your child. I think that is very normal situation.
So one of the numbers that you gave in your book said that something like 6 out of 10 migrants are kidnapped. Does that include, for example, the young women that you interviewed that became trafficked into sex slavery?
Yeah, that happened. That's an estimated made by the Senate in Mexico. That's one of the most hard situations. If the migrants from Central America who cross Mexico are a very vulnerable population, the women into that population are more, but much, much more vulnerable because organized crime, mostly in the kidnaps, the target on weapons, because they can sell women to brothels in the North Frontier for, it's not much money, but if you sell a lot of, that represents good profit, like $1,500, you can buy a woman in the North Frontier of Mexico. So yes, the aggression, the sexual harassment to women in other places where it's not the organized crime, it's just a normal thieves who are in the hiding places that migrants cross in Mexico. It's very common. they know that that's going to happen today in Mexico, and they assume that they're going to be raped in Mexico. It's already a normal situation. We think that, or migrants wrongly think that this is normal, and they assume that that's going to happen.
You also interviewed the Border Patrol in Arizona. What was your sense about that? After those interviews, what did you see? What was your realization?
I think that the United States know that it's impossible to stop migration. It's impossible. But the United States, the government, needs to have an strategic control of the frontier. But as the people that I meet in the Border Patrol in the sector of Tucson, Arizona, who is the huge base of the Border Patrol in the frontier, they understand themselves, an institution who fight against terrorism. They didn't find his first responsibility with migrant detentions or migrant issues. That's like the second thing in interest. See, yeah, tell me.
Looking at this now, you've interviewed all types of people who have faced some of the worst circumstances that a human being could possibly face. And we don't even know the whole story because so many of these migrants who are kidnapped and disappeared, there's no record anywhere of it. Given what you've seen and given the interviews that you did, both with the migrants and with the Border Patrol and with officials, how does one even start to come up with some kind of solution to this problem? It's so massive.
I think I have to know that I'm a very pessimistic guy, but I think that first at all, as a journalist, I have to say that talk about this situation is one of the steps to a change. I went in the United States last month, and I went in Washington, for example, yesterday, giving a speech. People in the United States don't really know about what happened with Central American migrants who arrived to the United States. In fact, they call us Mexicanos. I mean, it's like a generalization. All the people who came from Latin America are from Mexico. No, these people, before arrived to the United States, crossed the hell. It's different. I know that Mexican migrants have tough situations, but this is different. I mean, Mexico is a huge country to cross. But I think that talk about, publish about this issue in the United States is very important because it's a humanitarian crisis with Biden in Mexico. And second, let me see if I can pronounce that, if I find the correct words to say that. I think that Mexico have to create some precedent, making trials against these groups of Zetas or these groups of guys in Mexico who do that to the Central American migrants. If the message continue that if you do something with migrants who cross Mexico, never gonna happen with you, that's gonna continue happen. I mean, why Los Zetas or why the little groups of criminals going to stop if there is not a precedent on a trial on the justice system of Mexico? Why are you gonna stop anything happen? There is no consequences. I think that Mexico have to create that precedent to show to these organizations that something can happen if you do all that tortures, rape, and kidnaps to a population who just want to cross your country. I think that this is very important, and I think that both things have a relation. I think that publish and talk about the topic going to create the pressure for the Mexican authorities who have to create this precedent in the justice system, who send that message that something's going to happen. But right now, anything happened. I mean, for the massacre in 2011 of 193 Central American migrants and some Mexican migrants too, there is nobody in jail. Nobody was in a trial for that. There is no arrest. So the message is very clear. Do whatever you want because anything's going to happen. That's what I think that can help to check this situation.
Oscar Martinez, I want to thank you very much for your work and for sharing it with us here on the Scholar Circle.
I say thank you to you, and sorry for my English. I try to do my best, but let's see what happens.
Oscar Martinez is an award-winning journalist and author of The Beast, Riding the Rails and Dodging Narcos on the Migrant Trail. When we come back, the world of migration and the systems and policies that perpetuate many of the inhumane conditions. Stay tuned.
It's great to be in America. Ain't no lion or tiger, ain't no mamba snake. Just a sweet watermelon and a buckwheat cake. Everybody is as happy as a man can be. Climb aboard, little wog, sail away with me. Sail away, sail away. We will cross the mighty ocean into Charleston Bay. Sail away, sail away. We will cross the mighty ocean into Charleston Bay.
This is the Scholar Circle, and I'm Maria Armudian. U.S. President Barack Obama has been trying to persuade the Congress to revisit the issue of immigrant reform. But some policies that have been proposed merely perpetuate an underground shadow world of migrant smuggling in inhumane conditions, say experts. What is fueling mass migration, and how can the U.S. and the international community humanely solve the underlying problems? Three experts join us. Kevin Johnson is Dean and Professor of Public Interest Law at the University of California Davis School of Law. He is the author of Immigration Law and the U.S.-Mexico Border and co-author of Opening the Floodgates, Why America Needs to Rethink Its Borders and Immigration Laws. David Shirk is a professor of political science and international relations and the director of the Justice in Mexico Project at the University of San Diego. He has co-authored Drug Violence in Mexico, Data and Analysis Through 2013, Armed with Impunity, Curbing Military Human Rights Abuses in Mexico, and Contemporary Mexican Politics. David Kyle also joins us. David Kyle is a professor of sociology at the University of California, Davis. His publications include Global Human Smuggling, Comparative Perspectives, and Transnational Peasants, Migration Networks and Ethnicity in Andean Ecuador. Welcome to the Scholar Circle. It's great to have the three of you with us. What I'd like to start with is the motivation for migrants to upend their lives and migrate, given that some of them will face and do face very serious dangers. David Kyle, this is something that you've studied. What have you found?
Well, I found that people don't take this decision very lightly. I don't think that that should be any news, but most of the time there isn't just one factor or one dimension of why they might be leaving. There's usually a number of factors, both in the sending region and sometimes also strong attractions to the destination, often actual recruiters going into a region and actually trying to recruit them for jobs abroad. So often we see a number of factors at play.
When you say recruiters, do you mean corporations from developed countries?
Sometimes it's corporate recruiters. And historically, in certain regions of, for example, Mexico, there were actual recruiters starting in the 20s and 30s who were recruiting migrants to go north to factories in the northern United States. Some of those are the same communities that have sent migrants for decades, and so it starts a sort of social network snowball effect across generations. Today, that's more likely to be played by third-party intermediaries of what we call a migration industry. So people who profit from the brokering and recruitment, often paid by the migrants themselves.
So these are the smugglers that you studied in your other book, people who, it's kind of an underground thing.
That's true, but a lot of the activities are not really entirely underground or illegal. Migration industry includes a wide range of people making money in, through both licit and illicit activities, so transportation, communication. Many of the activities that they do are not illegal in the sending country and are often promoted as something very important to the sending country, because of the large sums of remittances that are sent back to the sending country.
In one of your books, I saw a number that you had retrieved from the United Nations. There were something like 50 million migrants of irregular status. What is that?
These are migrants who are traveling in some form that has not been completely sanctioned by a state. That's the broad definition.
One of the things that triggered this particular panel was we had interviewed a journalist who followed migrants from Central America through Mexico to try to get into the United States. And while they were going through certain parts of Mexico, they were facing Los Zetas most of the time, the drug cartel, which would kidnap them 100 at a time, 200 at a time in broad daylight, and either make a lot of money by asking for a ransom from their relatives, or enslaving in some cases, or trafficking them in some cases, or just disappearing them. Is this a common story?
This is David Shirk responding to the question, and I would say it is all too common. I wouldn't say it is the predominant story of migrants coming to the United States. It may be the predominant story of migrants coming to the United States through Mexico from Central America, insofar as there's the gauntlet that Central American migrants have to navigate in order to get to the United States is not just crossing the U.S.-Mexico border, which is itself fraught with many challenges, but also navigating from the Guatemalan-Mexican border to the Texas-Mexico border or any other portion of the border. There are a number of hazards that migrants face, including corrupt authorities at the federal and local level, transnational and local gangs and organized crime groups, including the Zetas, not limited to the Zetas, and also physical hazards, the challenges of physically being transported from the southern Mexican border up into our border and across it involves many life-threatening physical hazards, whether you're talking about the trains that migrants climb upon in the dead of night and have to hold on to at risk of death or loss of limb if they should fall off, to the physical challenges of getting across the U.S. border and possibly being shot or harmed by a Border Patrol agent, and the dangers that they put themselves in the hands of smugglers. And if they're on their own, crawling through the deserts at day or night, they're exposed to extreme elements. They run into deadly animals and dangerous animals like rattlesnakes. So really we're talking about a range of challenges that migrants face. And in many cases, even if they pay thousands of dollars to get safe transit to the United States, they're confronted at some point or another by these kinds of challenges.
Kevin Johnson.
I think that the speakers have it exactly right. The journey to the United States through Mexico is dangerous, both for Mexicans and even more so perhaps for Central Americans. The dangers run the gamut from criminal elements to the conditions, and things don't get much better in some respects once they get to the United States, where they're subject to exploitation in the workplace and other mistreatment.
And is there anything else you'd like to add on to this, David Kyle?
I want to emphasize the point about safe houses, that in the media it's almost always constructed as a criminal syndicate holding them for ransom. But often the so-called safe houses are actually safe houses in which the migrants are waiting for their family members here to pay the smuggling fees, and that was within the arrangement that they made with the smuggler. I would add that the migrants are traveling in a way that does not allow them to step forward to the law enforcement locally or at the destination, and so they're really completely at the mercy of these syndicates and criminal gangs that often hold them for ransom.
Now, do we have any types of numbers about what percentage of migrants survive this trek David Shirk?
Yeah, I don't think we have. First of all, we don't have very good numbers on the size of the undocumented or the irregular migrant populations. So I don't think we have rock-solid numbers, but I do think that we're talking about tens of thousands of people who are exposed to these risks. We know, for example, that just in terms of trying to measure the number of migrants that fall victim to organized crime, we know that hundreds, if not thousands, have been killed in recent years by a body count of mass graves in Mexico, in particularly northeastern Mexico. It's reasonable to use those kinds of figures. But David really pressed an important point here, which is all migrants are vulnerable to exploitation, and especially all undocumented immigrant people who are moving through any country without proper legal documentation, who have what we would call irregular status. So those groups are especially vulnerable for the reasons that have been mentioned. So it doesn't just stop with trafficking organizations, although that has become a mini industry for certain organized crime groups like the Zetas.
I think both you, David Shirk, and I think also David Kyle talked about some of the factors that are actually leading to some trends that are particularly scary. One is the idea of erecting these really strong borders that make it so that migrants do have to rely on either smugglers or other people who will get them through. So it has given rise to this. David Kyle, why don't we go back to you on this?
Well, much like Prohibition in the 1920s, when you have a flow that is completely normalized and, as I said, recruited over decades, and then all of a sudden we erect very hard barriers and enforcement programs, it was not surprising that people would continue to migrate. There are still jobs on the side of the border. They often do not hire the smuggler until they have the job on this side of the border. The culture of migration, but also the global culture and narrative around global capitalism that says, you know, you need to go global. You need to think about not only your local region, but other regions, not to mention the cultural production in places like California that produce movies and other media that show the lifestyle that we lead here. So you kind of combine that with, on the other hand, for many people around the world, especially in South America and Central America, leaving home or innovating and developing in their home region is not as easy as what the images may portray and the kinds of lifestyle that they see and would like to have themselves.
David Shirk?
I think that the hardening of the border has, without doubt, been the primary cause of the development of organized crime and the increased sophistication of organized crime in Mexico, both with regard to the drug trade and with regard to undocumented immigration. You know, 30 years ago, you didn't need a smuggler or a coyote to get you across the border. You could very easily walk across the border in many sections by yourself or with someone who had a little bit of experience. And by making it much more difficult, by creating this prohibition regime, as David Kyle was suggesting, we've essentially created a black market for labor. There's a certain profit that can be obtained as a result of that black market, and criminal enterprises have moved in. And it creates a problem for law enforcement, that it now has to confront. And that it's also a problem for the migrants, because these are essentially predatory organizations. And what's, I think, particularly worrying is that we've seen organized crime groups that are involved in people smuggling also venture into now other areas, including human trafficking, as you've described, a sort of blanket term for basically exploiting people who are in transit. And also other kinds of sort of criminal entities. So I think that the key challenge that we face at the border is how do we get people out of the shadows? How do we regularize flows so that we reduce the profitability of people smuggling, and also, you know, give the migrants themselves recourse to talk to law enforcement, to be part of the formal economy, and to basically be better contributors to the economic activities that they are already engaged in.
Kevin Johnson, you've looked at this in terms of the legal aspects of the U.S. and the policy aspects of the U.S. What do you think we should learn from the long arc of history with the U.S. law and policy and immigrants?
Well, I think one of the things that we have to learn and we need to act upon is the fact that what is going on here, no small part, is a labor migration. And historically, it's been a labor migration, and it's not exclusively a labor migration. There are family and other networks that contribute to immigration. But we can't just stop the demand for migrating to the United States by building fences, putting more boots on the ground, as the president would say, or having drones fly across the border. The very important point that you made is that more enforcement has had some collateral impacts that deserve certain attention. One of them is that before the border operations of the 1990s, smuggling fees were relatively small. Maybe a few hundred dollars to get across south of San Diego. Now there are thousands of dollars to get across. That's brought in some of the criminal networks that have been talked about, and that's had negative collateral consequences on the migrants. At the same time, the enforcement measures in San Diego and El Paso, for example, have funneled migrants into more dangerous, more isolated locations where they're more subject to the elements, more subject to criminal conduct, and more likely to die. So we have a system now where smugglers are charging large fees, people are dying by the day, and at the same time, we're not having much of an impact on our undocumented immigrant population in the United States. Basically, the population today is best estimated about 11 million people. It changed a little bit with the recession beginning in 2008, but really hasn't changed much, even though we've increased enforcement by millions of dollars a year, deportations by hundreds of thousands a year. And so I think we have to think very carefully in terms of future immigration reform, what we can do to regularize migration flows from countries where there's labor that wants to migrate, and if that labor gets here, employers will employ that labor. So to me, what we have to learn is that our immigration laws can't ignore what's going on in the rest of the world, can't ignore the demand for labor in the United States, and can't simply try to seal off this nation from what's going on globally.
One of the other things that I saw in your writing, Kevin Johnson, dealt with the law in the context of our civil rights history. How would you describe that for us to understand?
Well, I think that historically, immigration law has enforced racial and other boundaries in the United States. You can look through the history of the immigration laws and see who the demons of every particular era was. You could see a time when the Irish were excluded, when the Chinese were excluded, when other Asian groups were excluded. Now you see a time where Mexicans, in no small part, are excluded. I do think that it's too frequent the case that immigration law and enforcement in these times is discussed as if it were isolated and separate from race. But we know, as a nation, which groups are most dramatically affected by immigration law and enforcement, and so do those groups. They know that as well. And if you look at our deportation numbers, you look at the focus along the U.S.-Mexico border in particular, you can make a colorable argument that our laws are designed primarily to keep Mexicans out of the United States. So I do think that these issues need to be discussed. But historically, we have used the immigration laws to keep out the people we don't want in this country, whether it be homosexuals, whether it be criminals, whether it be racial minorities, whether it be poor people or people with moderate income. We have a very rich, if not unfortunate, history of that.
Let me just remind listeners now that they're listening to the Scholar Circle, and we're speaking with Kevin Johnson, David Kyle, and David Shirk about issues of migration and immigration and the dynamics of that globally. Let's bring David Kyle back in. What would you add to this?
Well, I want to go back to a point that was made earlier about the rise of criminal syndicates and the prices of smugglers, that there's a direct connection to that, and emphasize that 20, 30 years ago, there were practically no real criminal syndicates involved directly in the smuggling part of the business. The reason for that is that the migrants also have to trust the smuggler, and the smuggler has to trust the migrants, and that generally migrants paid on credit. So you pay after arrival. And so there's a sort of loan involved, sometimes directly by the smugglers, sometimes by a third party. Sometimes they are kind of loan sharks, but be that as it may, it got them across the border. Often guarantees were part of the deal. One of the interesting things about that is around the world, we tend to see the same guarantee of three times, that the smuggler will try three times. If you're caught twice, you go back and try again without any additional cost. However, as the border has gotten more difficult, smuggling fees have gone up. It's only in the last 5 to 10 years that, because of the attraction of the huge profits that can now be made because of that fact, criminal syndicates have started to get into the business directly, especially in Mexico. This is a relatively recent development.
One of the journalists that we interviewed talked about how much money is made in the ransom process and how that has become a huge business. Has anybody documented that? Do you know David Shirk?
I haven't seen scholarship or efforts to try to tally the profits that are made. I think there are good efforts, for example, at the University of California, San Diego, to track the fees that are paid by migrants, but looking at profit margins and how the business side of migrant smuggling works, I think is not something that has been
well. And this journalist was speaking particularly about the ransoms that the cartels or the other organized crime groups collect after abducting.
And I think that's really poorly understood. You can look at a lot of the rhetoric that came out over the last couple of years about how those ransoms have worked. You know, in Phoenix, which is a major corridor, Arizona as a major corridor for migration flows, the local law enforcement of Phoenix and other parts of the state have tried to suggest that Phoenix and other parts of Arizona are the kidnapping capital of the United States, and they really place this great emphasis on the threat that results from cartel activity. And what they're really doing is kind of conflating the kinds of ransoms that you're describing with the problem of migrant smuggling and how people are being held for to pay off their fees or additional fees that are imposed. And I think that that phenomenon hasn't been well studied, and it's also been significantly distorted by law enforcement officials who have an agenda to boost their budgets and get national attention from Congress to deal with problems that they've conflated. So, I think you're right that it's not something that's well examined.
Well, let's turn to some solutions. Like, where should the U.S. go from this point? And where should we go internationally to deal with this, you know, kind of inhumane problem that we're facing really all over the world? And perhaps, Kevin Johnson, we should start with you with the law and public policy.
Well, my view is that we really need to think seriously as a nation about some meaningful immigration reform that deals with labor migration and allows for low and medium-skilled workers to migrate lawfully to the United States. Where the smuggling and criminal networks come into play is when there's no legal way for otherwise law-abiding people to come to the United States. And I do fear that the discussion of cartels and the criminal element may lead some to believe that the migrants themselves are criminals, when for the most part we know that they come here to work and not necessarily to be engaged in any criminal activities, even though their entry may be done unlawfully. But in my estimation, what needs to be done, and it hasn't been done in the last 100 years of American immigration law, is to look carefully about the supply and demand of labor and pay some attention to that economic reality in fashioning a law that allows for realistic immigration and doesn't require unrealistic enforcement that leads to the kinds of problems we have today.
David Kyle?
I agree. Originally, the North American Free Trade Agreement, known as NAFTA, had the free flow of people as well. And that part of the policy was taken out relatively at the last minute. I think that's probably unrealistic to have a sort of free trade area or harmonizing our economies and to some extent even our polities, but not really allowing for the free flow of people, especially people seeking jobs.
And David Shirk, you've actually testified about this and done cost-benefit analysis. What would you say?
No, I think that's absolutely the case. I think there's a fairly broad consensus among experts on immigration that the flows of migrants into the country, if the flows of migrants into the country were regularized, you would not have to worry about border security. And in many ways, certain interests in Congress and certain voices around the country have advocated for putting the cart before the horse, building fences before regularizing flows. And that is really something that I think exacerbates the problem. It makes it seem like the border's out of control and that we will never get it under control. But the minute that we make some kind of serious and comprehensive reform of our immigration system to allow people to come here legally for whom there is work and for whom there are real opportunities, the problems that we have at the border, at least with regard to immigration, I think will largely go away.
Finally, when you look at Washington and Kevin Johnson, I think you had been critical of our president, President Obama, and his approach. And you've also been critical of people who, such as Sam Huntington, who have expressed concern about national identity. What do you think are the problems with these responses?
I mean, in terms of the Obama administration, I guess I would point to the fact that, well, some kind of immigration reform has been promised. What we've primarily seen in this administration is increasing deportations over time. And this president has deported more non-citizens than any president in the United States history, and currently is deporting about 400,000 people a year. Now, there are promises that there's going to be some, and there have been some marginal improvements in immigration enforcement and in the treatment of immigrants. But we've been waiting quite a long time for some kind of meaningful change to the immigration laws. And I know it's Congress's court, but there has to be some bigger push, and there currently is quite a push in Washington, D.C. for immigration reform. But to me, what you see out of the Obama administration is more and more deportation, more and more promises, but not more and more meaningful reform. In terms of the Samuel Huntingtons of the world, I do think it's important for us to have a discussion about national identity and what this country is. But at the same time, what I'm averse to is people like Samuel Huntington saying what the national identity is and shouldn't be, which in his views, in Anglo-Saxon nation, a non-Catholic nation, and a non-Hispanic nation. So I'm not against having a dialogue about identity, but I am against trying to impose one on the nation as a whole. And I think that that's the kind of discussion we should have as a country, but not being having one imposed from the outside.
And final words, David Kyle.
I believe we only have to look at Silicon Valley here in Northern California to see how the diversity of that region, by especially the flow of immigrants and the human capital and creativity and imagination that they bring the different ideas from around the world has contributed so much to the success of Silicon Valley, to point to how, yes, identity is important, but it's in this combination that really is the key feature of the American experience about creative change and how we see ourselves moving forward.
And David Shirk.
Yeah, and to reiterate that point from a Southern California perspective, I think one of the best immigration protest signs that I've seen at rallies and protests is no Mexicans, no burritos. if you don't let the people in, you don't get to experience the benefits that we have always enjoyed as a nation of immigrants. And I think that's going back to the earlier point. That is Samuel Huntington's great mistake. He wants to take an 1820s view of what the United States is. And that what's brilliant to me about the idea of America is that it is the idea and one of the only countries in the world that is founded on the idea that it is a place for all people to come and make into a great nation.
Well, that's a perfect place to leave it. Thank you to all three of you for joining us here on the Scholar Circle and sharing your thoughts and your research with us. Kevin Johnson, David Kyle, David Shirk, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Kevin Johnson is Dean and Professor of Public Interest Law at the University of California Davis School of Law. He is the author of Immigration Law and the U.S.-Mexico Border and co-author of Opening the Floodgates, Why America Needs to Rethink Its Borders and Immigration Laws. David Shirk is a professor of political science and international relations and the director of the Justice in Mexico Project at the University of San Diego. He has co-authored Drug Violence in Mexico, Data and Analysis Through 2013, Armed with Impunity, Curbing Military Human Rights Abuses in Mexico, and Contemporary Mexican Politics. David Kyle is a professor of sociology at the University of California, Davis. His publications include Global Human Smuggling, Comparative Perspectives, and Transnational Peasants, Migration Networks and Ethnicity in Andean Ecuador. That's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to the Scholar Circle team who makes this show possible, Ankine Agassian, Melissa Chiprin. Most of all, thank you for listening. And if you missed a part of the show, you can go back either to the kpfk.org audio archives, or you can go to scholarcircle.org. You can hear us on iTunes and on Stitcher, and you can follow me at Armudian.
Sail away. Sail away. We will cross the mighty ocean into Charleston Bay. Sail away. Sail away. We will cross the mighty ocean into Charleston.